Okay, please report, Mr. Clark, this is an argument petition.
Okay, please report, my name is Jeffrey Clark, law firm of Kelso, Anderson & Curry in Dallas, Texas. This is a medical malpractice case concerning the puncture of Mr. Haddock's colon during a colon examination. The case was pled as a race ipsa case and also pled as specific acts of negligence. Generally, in a race ipsa case, it can be established through within common knowledge of laymen or through expert testimony. That is the rule provided by the Mobile Chemical Acts. The basis for the race ipsa rule is to have an inference of negligence through the general conduct when there is no specific evidence of specific acts of negligence. It originated in the Flower cases where a flower barrel would roll out the window and there's no specific acts of what went wrong, but the general occurrence gives rise to an inference of negligence. In Texas, res ipsa loquitur can be established by either the common knowledge of the layman or expert testimony as to every profession, every business, and every individual. In this case, they're trying to say that does not apply to the area of medical malpractice. You cannot establish res ipsa loquitur through expert testimony in medical malpractice cases. That's the position of Dr. Arnspider in this case. Now, contrary to that, the Court of Appeals in two Texas cases prior to the 1977 Medical Act stated in dicta that expert testimony could establish the basis for medical malpractice, res ipsa loquitur in medical malpractice. And those cases are cited in our brief. Additionally, the authority of Mr. Jim Perdue, cited in our brief, established the fact that res ipsa loquitur can be established in a medical malpractice case through expert testimony. The law in the other states, as far as whether you can establish res ipsa loquitur through expert testimony, is that you can. That's the law in California, that's the law in Illinois, that's the law in New Jersey, and that's the law in Pennsylvania. I cite the court to Prosser for those citations and cite the court to produce articles concerning those citations. In our case, we did plead res ipsa loquitur, and prior to the trial of our case, our pleadings were stricken concerning that allegation of res ipsa loquitur. Our position and our point of error concerning this is that you cannot strike pleadings prior to the trial of the case when you can have expert testimony concerning the basis for the res ipsa loquitur pleading. In Texas, there's two elements to the res ipsa loquitur pleading, that the occurrence would not usually occur in the absence of negligence, and the instrumentality was under the exclusive control of the defendant. Those are the predicate facts. If you exclude the ability to have expert testimony concerning those predicate facts, you exclude the ability to use res ipsa loquitur, and that's what happened in our case. We were not able to have an issue submitted to the jury concerning whether the conduct itself, the occurrence itself, the colon puncture itself, was negligence. And we believe that the court's striking of that pleading and preventing us having an issue on that matter was incorrect. Now, with the actual facts of our case, there was testimony by our expert doctors that the occurrence itself, being a colon puncture, would not happen in the absence of negligence. It was undisputed that the colonoscope, the mechanical instrument that performed the colon examination, was under the exclusive control of Dr. Armstrong. So in our case, the factual predicate, both elements, were established through expert testimony. Now, the Mobile Chemical case states that once you do establish res ipsa loquitur in a non-medical malpractice case, then you're entitled to a single general issue: was the injury itself, was the act itself, negligence. You're entitled to a single negligence issue compared to specific issues of what could have happened or what must have happened to get the end result. In our case, we submitted a single general negligence issue to the trial court. that single general negligence issue was included by the trial court in the preliminary charge that he prepared prior to the actual submission of the charge to the jury. That issue was taken out and was refused to be included in the court's charge. So if the court please, the predicate facts not occurring in the absence of negligence, that the instrumentality was under the defendant's exclusive control, were established through expert testimony. We requested our issue concerning a single general negligence issue, and that issue was refused. And based upon the refusal of the issue, the jury found no negligence as to Dr. Arnsparger, but did find $95,000 worth of damages. The purpose of the res ipsa loquitur theory is to give inference to negligence when there's no way to prove what specifically must have happened. In our case, Mr. Haddock was unconscious during a colonoscopy examination. He was present, the doctor was present, and the nurse was present, and our man's unconscious. At the trial of the case, there was testimony that the man must have pushed too hard in his examination, that the bowel must not have been prepared too well, that he must not have known the anatomy of the colon, or that he didn't make the turn properly. But all these are must have done this, must have done that. The res ipsa loquitur says that if the act itself doesn't ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence, you don't have to rely on must have and must have and must have. You are entitled to an issue concerning the entire scope of the defendant's conduct, whether the injury itself would constitute negligence. And I would submit to the court that in our case, the jury was not able to find any of these must haves, but they could have found that the entire procedure itself and the doctor's actions itself would constitute negligence. The pattern jury charge references the issue to be submitted to the jury in a res ipsa case, and the issue is, was Mr. Haddock's injury due to the negligence of Dr. Arnsbach? That's the issue that we requested in this case, and that's the issue that we were entitled to in this case. And because we did not get that issue, the plaintiff was prevented from recovery in this case. And that's the two points of error that were brought in this case. One is the res ipsa pleadings were incorrectly stricken, and secondly, we were entitled to a res ipsa issue which we were not provided.
What is the effect of the Medical Liability and Insurance Improvement Act with reference to your res ipsa claim?
The Medical Improvements Act was in 1977. Prior to 1977, there were these two Court of Appeals cases that we've cited, the Hamilton versus Sowers case and the Southwest Texas Medical case, that specifically state that res ipsa loquitur may be established in a medical malpractice case through expert testimony. So prior to the Act, we have Texas courts saying that you can establish res ipsa through expert testimony. So in answer to your question, I think that the Act does not prevent us from establishing res ipsa through expert testimony. It's consistent with our case law.
The Act says that res ipsa is to be applied only in those cases where it has been applied by the appellate courts of the state prior to the effective date of the action.
Yes, sir.
Aren't those two cases that you referred to ones that involve essentially different kinds of circumstances than what is involved in this case?
I think there's two ways to interpret that statute. The strict interpretation where it's got to be exactly the same type of case that was determined prior to the Act, or the more moderate approach where it's concerned with the same type of cases that were tried and ruled on prior to the Act. And I believe the moderate approach is the approach that's most predominant right now. Did it concern or did it relate to the same type of action or same type of case that occurred prior to that Act in 1977? And using that approach and that interpretation, then our case falls within those previously ruled on. The court, please, the question in our case is whether res ipsa can be established through expert testimony. There are two cases that existed prior to the Act that said it could. the law in the other states, California, Illinois, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, say res ipsa can be established through expert testimony. And the commentary of Mr. Perdue said res ipsa can be established through expert testimony. To prevent a plaintiff in a malpractice case from proving this case and establishing this case just because the defendant happens to be a doctor, as compared to any other profession, any other business, or any other individual, cannot be the law in this state. And the two prior court appeals cases, the other jurisdictions' cases, and the commentators indicate that that cannot be correct, and that you must be able to establish res ipsa through expert testimony, even in a medical malpractice case. And in our case, we were not provided that res ipsa issue. Our pleadings were stricken, and we believe those actions by the trial court were incorrect, and thus led to an incorrect judgment in this case.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear now from respondent.
Yeah, please, the court, Mr. Barrios, is an argument for response.
Thank you, may it please the court. My name is Mike Berry. I'm here with Jerry Grissom. We're with the firm of Thompson Knight in Dallas. We represent Dr. Larry A. Arnsfiger and Physicians and Surgeons Clinic, the respondents to this appeal, the defendants below. Now, this is a case involving allegations of medical negligence. I think it's important for the court to take note of the fact that this case went to trial on a pleading of numerous specific acts and omissions that were alleged against Dr. Arnsfiger in connection with this procedure. After a full and fair trial on the merits, special issues were submitted to the jury. The jury was asked about 9 specific acts or omissions. The jury returned a specific finding that 2 of those acts or omissions had in fact occurred. However, the jury refused to find that either of those acts or omissions constituted negligence. Now, we fully set forth the facts of the case in our brief. I want to move on to the specific issues that are before the court today. And I'm going to talk about these issues I'm going to focus my arguments in 2 respects. First of all, the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur has absolutely nothing to do with this case. Second, even if it did, the plaintiff has waived his right to rely on it in this case. The first point, res ipsa loquitur has absolutely nothing to do with this case, either factually or under the law. Res ipsa loquitur is inapplicable. The court's aware that this case is governed by statute.
What makes it inapplicable, counsel?
I'm sorry?
What makes it inapplicable?
It's inapplicable under 2 reasons, Your Honor. First, legally and factually. It's legally inapplicable in this case because of the operation of the statute. The Medical Liability and Insurance Improvement Act of 1977, Section 7.01, states that the doctrine of res ipsa loquitur shall only apply to those cases to which it's previously been applied. This case is not one of those cases.
What about those two cases cited by counsel of 2 court of appeals that recognize res ipsa in medical malpractice case?
Well, Your Honor, I think you have to look at the totality of the pre-1977 case law. And I think when you do that, you find 2 things. Number one, the statement that res ipsa loquitur is generally inapplicable to medical malpractice cases. There is a narrow exception that is recognized when cases fall within the common knowledge of laymen. Now, there are the 2 cases that counsel has talked about, the Southwest Texas case and the Hamilton case. We feel, Your Honor, that those cases erroneously suggest in dicta that the law at that time allowed establishment of res ipsa by medical testimony alone. I want to point out to the court, neither case were those a specific holding by those courts that res ipsa loquitur was established by medical testimony or could be established by medical testimony. At best, the statement in those cases is dicta only, and it should not be followed.
The proposition for which you argue sounds like that the res ipsa is not available to any plaintiff in any medical malpractice case. Because if it's not applicable in a situation where if there's common knowledge and requires expert testimony, then you're saying it's not allowed where expert testimony is required.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying that the exception is any case that the facts and circumstances bring the case within the common knowledge of laymen, the case is automatically appropriate for res ipsa. Now, you may have expert testimony.
Like leaving the clip inside the body after surgery.
That's correct.
That type of thing.
That's correct.
But it would not be available with expert testimony?
It would be available with expert testimony if the facts are such that they come within the common knowledge of layman. It does not exclude the ability of a person to introduce expert testimony. What we're saying is that for complex medical procedures that are outside the common knowledge of layman, that common layman cannot understand without expert testimony, that the law requires that the court not apply res ipsa, and that's mandated by the statute. That's what we feel is mandated by the statute. If you look at the pre-1977 case law, as I've indicated, there are two themes that are predominant. Number one, res ipsa loquitur is not applicable to medical malpractice cases. The second theme is a few courts recognize a narrow exception, and those are cases that fall within the common knowledge of layman.
Put another way, then, your position is that res ipsa is only available in those cases where expert testimony is not necessary.
That's correct, Aaron. That's correct.
And that's what you feel, that's the way you would interpret the 77 Act.
That's correct.
That was only preserving that narrow area.
That's absolutely correct. The Rayner case, Your Honor, that we cited in our brief, it's a Waco case in 1975, we feel correctly states the law that the legislature intended to freeze as of the date of the statute. The Rayner case gave examples of the cases that are appropriate for res ipsa. These are cases that involve improper use of mechanical instruments. I'm going to distinguish that from medical instruments in a minute. Cases in which a doctor operates on the wrong part of the body. This is something that lay jurors can understand. If a person goes in for an operation on his left arm and he ends up with an operation on his right arm, that is a case that's appropriate for res ipsa loquitur. Leaving sponges, foreign bodies inside the body after surgery, that's something that laymen can understand should not happen. Those are the cases that are appropriate.
But counsel, wouldn't you say that the use of an instrument into the colon would not be a mechanical device?
Your Honor, it's not a mechanical device. It's a sophisticated medical instrument. And there's a distinction that has to be made there. And there's a distinction that has been made in the case law. For instance, there is a case that has held that the use of a dental drill by a dentist is not something that falls within the common knowledge of layman. It's something that requires expert testimony to explain to the jury. And so this case, it is similar to that to the holding in that case.
But you have a hard instrument that perforates the lining of the colon. I don't understand your distinction. I can understand a drill, but this is a hard instrument that is inserted into the body and perforates the colon.
Your Honor, the scope is a flexible instrument. It's a fiber optic instrument that's flexible so that it can move through the colon, and the doctor directs it through the colon. It's not a rigid instrument, and it's distinguishable on that point.
This was the new technique as opposed to the old one with the 8-inch steel cylinder.
That's correct. That's correct. This is a fiber optic instrument, Your Honor. It's the size of your finger, and it's flexible. It moves through the colon. It's not a case of a mechanical instrument. It's simply not that. The Court of Appeals recognized that in its opinion. It's a sophisticated medical instrument. It requires expert testimony. It's outside the common knowledge of layman.
Is there any dispute in the record of this case that the plaintiff presented expert evidence, that this incident would not have occurred in the absence of negligence?
Yes, Your Honor, we do dispute that. We think that res ipsa loquitur not only is legally inapplicable under the statute, under the legislative enactment, we feel it's factually inapplicable to this case. If you look at the proof that's been cited by the plaintiff in his brief in support of his notion that he had testimony that this ordinarily doesn't occur but for someone's negligence, that is not what it says. His proof speaks to this specific case. Nowhere did any of his experts say this is something that just would not happen unless somebody had been negligent. That is not in the record. His experts talk about what they do say is this is a generally safe procedure. This sort of thing generally doesn't happen, but they all recognize that it does happen. The testimony, the predicate for res ipsa, that the accident be such that it not ordinarily occur but for someone's negligence, quite simply is not in this record. In fact, what is in this record is precisely to the contrary. All the experts who testified agreed this is a recognized risk of this procedure. It's something that happens in a certain percentage of cases, regardless of whether anyone's negligent. Even Dr. Klein, one of the plaintiff experts, agreed that this can happen in the best of hands. He even told the jury that he could go out and perforate someone's colon tomorrow, and that wouldn't be negligent.
So factually, res ipsa loquitur is inapplicable. Your Honor, I want to emphasize the point as to what the status of the pre-1977 case law was. Our position is supported by cases that have been decided since 1977. There are three cases that we've cited in our brief. They're on page 26 of our brief. They have all held that pre-1977 case law on this point was, one, res ipsa loquitur is generally inapplicable. Two, there's a narrow exception, and the exception requires the facts and circumstances bring the case within the common knowledge of laymen. This case is not one of those cases. Operation of the flexible instrument, operation of this procedure is not something that's within the common knowledge of laymen. It's legally inapplicable.
Was there any evidence of ulcerative colitis in this case?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Of a big cancer?
No, Your Honor. This was a routine screening procedure that the plaintiff was undergoing because he had polyps in his colon. This was a recommended annual procedure.
Wasn't Dr. Klein's testimony that if you didn't have ulcerative colitis and didn't have a big cancer, that the only thing that could cause this type of incident was operator error?
I don't recall that in the record, Your Honor. I don't think that is correct. I think also that his statement that's pertinent is that this is a recognized risk of the procedure regardless of the plaintiff's condition. It's a recognized risk. It's going to happen. In a healthy person, it's going to happen.
But if he was, if this was a routine procedure, why would he be under total anesthetic?
Your Honor, I think he was anesthetized because the doctor was going to perform another procedure, and I think that he was anesthetized in part because of the plaintiff's request. Plaintiff requested it, is my understanding of what happened.
This is also known as a proctoscopic, is it not?
It's more than that, Your Honor. This is a longer scope.
Oh, I understand. 72 inches?
Something like that. It allows a complete examination of the complete length of the colon.
I understand.
It's not very pleasant experience.
I'm sure it's not. I've not had it done, but I wouldn't expect it would be. My second point, Your Honor, is even if the court concludes that res ipsa loquitur was applicable in this case, the plaintiff waived his right to rely on. Now, the plaintiff has complained about two rulings by the trial court. First, the ruling on the special exception. The trial court sustained our special exception, held that this was not a case in which res ipsa loquitur should apply and struck the pleadings. Plaintiff complains about the trial court's ruling on that point. However, the second point that he complains about is the jury charge. Now, we feel that he's waived both these points. He hasn't properly preserved his error. He waived the ruling on the special exception by his own argument to the court this morning. He says that the harm that resulted from the ruling on the special exception was he didn't get his jury issue. Well, it's clear from the brief that he submitted to the court, and it's clear from the argument that he's made to this court, that he got in the evidence that he wanted to get in on this point. He got in the evidence that he considers to be res ipsa loquitur evidence. Accordingly, any ruling on the special exception is moot at that point. A ruling on a special exception that strikes a pleading, at most the harm that will result from that is a party cannot introduce evidence. Mr. Haddock got in his evidence. Therefore, the ruling on the special exception doesn't matter anymore. Where the harm came to the plaintiff was they failed to follow up on that. They did not offer a trial amendment. The rules required, after they got in the evidence, there were two things incumbent upon them to do that they did not do. Number one, they had to offer a trial amendment. That's under Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 67. The mobile chemical company itself recognizes that before you can submit an issue to the jury on res ipsa, you have to have a proper pleading. He's required to offer a trial amendment to his pleadings, and he didn't do so. The second requirement that he was required to do was submit an issue in substantially correct wording. And that ties into the next point. There is no issue before this court to review. There is nothing in the record that indicates that the plaintiff requested a res ipsa loquitur issue. Accordingly, he's waived his complaint about it. It's clear, Your Honor, that to preserve error on a jury submission, there's two requirements. Rule 279, which was in effect at the time of the trial of this case, requires a written submission that the issue be tendered in written form in substantially correct form in order to preserve error. The rule specifically states that in the absence of a written request, there's no complaint about the jury charge. Nowhere in
this... If your pleading's been struck, why would it be necessary to preserve error to submit an issue?
Your Honor, because he got in the evidence that he wanted to get in.
What difference does that make? If you don't have any pleadings, the evidence just stands there unsupported and without going any direction.
If he intended, Your Honor, to submit a jury charge inquiring as to Ray's interlocutor, it was incumbent upon him to amend his pleading. He can't come into this court and say, they struck my special exception, and so therefore I've got error, and at the same time come in and tell this court, I got in the evidence, I should have got my issue. He can't have it both ways, and that's exactly what he's trying to do. He can't complain about the ruling on the special exception because he put in his evidence. He's also complaining to you about the fact that he didn't get his issue. So it was incumbent upon him, if he really wanted the issue, to amend his pleadings to support submission of the issue. Not only that, but as I've indicated, this record nowhere indicates that he even requested the issue. In order to preserve his error, he was required to submit a written issue. One, submit a written issue that appears in the record, and two, obtain a ruling on that issue in the record. Neither of those appear in this record. Not only that, not only is there no written submission, is there no written record in the record before this court. At the charge conference, at the time for objecting to the charge, plaintiffs made no oral objection to the failure of the trial court to submit the issue that he said he wanted. There's absolutely nothing in the record before this court that preserves error on the point. Your Honor, I think this is a simple case, really. The two points I've discussed, number one, res interlocutor is simply not applicable to this case. We're faced with a legislative mandate that res interlocutor apply only to those cases that is applied prior to the effective date of that law. The law as of 1977 was res interlocutor does not apply to medical negligence cases except where the case falls within the common knowledge of layman. Our interpretation of pre-1977 case law is supported by post-1977 case law. This case was not appropriate. Second, even if it were theoretically appropriate, the point has been waived. For these reasons, we respectfully pray that the court affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals and the trial court. Thank you.
Court, please. Counsel mentioned evidence that lay jurors can understand. An expert's testimony, this doesn't ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence, I think a lay juror can understand. A juror can understand that testimony by an expert. I don't see a basis for taking a doctrine, the doctrine of res interlocutor, and having it inapplicable to a medical malpractice case by saying, doctor, you can't testify that this act ordinarily doesn't occur in the absence of negligence. I don't think that can be the law. This court recently, in the Birchfield opinion, has stated that doctors can testify as to the ultimate issue of the case. They can testify whether the actions and conduct of the doctor constitute negligence. I think the ability of a doctor to testify whether the act itself was negligence and the ability to have expert testimony in the area of medical malpractice whether the act would not ordinarily occur in the absence of negligence are consistent and blend together and indicate that medical malpractice in a reciprocal case should be established through expert testimony. I don't see a basis for excluding this as to just medical malpractice, not excluded to any other profession, business, or individual. With respect to the actual testimony of the case, the testimony by Dr. Klein, as cited on page 8 of our brief, is, doctor, is it your opinion that the actual perforation of the colon was below the standard of care in Dallas County, Texas? Answer, yes, sir. There was direct testimony that the perforation itself was negligence. Now, Justice Doggett mentioned about the testimony of Dr. Klein. Dr. Klein's other testimony was that this was a routine colon examination. Only went to 60 centimeters, which is the minimal procedure. His testimony was that Mr. Colon had a healthy colon. Mr. Haddock had a healthy colon. And his further testimony was in a routine screening examination on a healthy colon, there should not be a puncture of the colon for the reason if there's any difficulty, any problem, the colonoscope should be withdrawn immediately. So his testimony in the record was that in this case, there never should be a colon puncture. the type of case that Mr. Haddock had done to him. So that testimony is in the record to establish the res ipsa predicate facts. With respect to the issue we submitted, the issue was submitted to the court on the first day of the trial or prior to the trial through requested special issues instructions to the court. It was hand-delivered to the court. It was not file stamped, but it was hand-delivered to the court. And Judge Whittington has a computer up there, and he prepares his charges on his computer. And the preliminary charge in our case had the res ipsa issue whether the perforation of the colon itself was negligence. And we attached that to our brief. And counsel does not dispute that issue was submitted to the court and was included within the court's preliminary charge. They don't dispute that. Now, Mobil Chemical says that in a res ipsa case, you're entitled to a general single negligence issue. And the pattern jury charge states that that issue was the injury caused by the negligence of the defendant. And that's the issue that we had requested to the court, and it was included within the preliminary charge. So I would submit to the court that we did request our issue. They don't dispute we requested our issue. And that the court refused such issue, even though it was in the correct form, in accordance with the Mobil Chemical case, and in accordance with the Texas battered jury charge. The real reason that you need a res ipsa locator doctrine and we have is it to be able to evidence your case on inferences. If a man is unconscious and his colon is punctured during that examination, there's an inference that something went wrong. Now, Mr. Haddock can't testify, none of our doctors can testify what specifically went wrong. And there's no direct testimony on what specifically went wrong. And I'll submit to the court that's why we could not gain an affirmative finding from the jurors on any of these things that must have happened, but we didn't know happened. And that's why we're entitled to a single issue was the injury that Mr. Haddock received caused by the negligence of Dr. Armstrong. And I think that's the issue that we're entitled to. That's the issue that makes sense. And because we did not get that issue, the jury could not reach the correct result in this case. The jury did find two issues for us. What they found was that Dr. Armstrong punctured the colon, and they did not determine the puncture of the colon. Neither of those related to the specific action that he did wrong to cause the colon puncture. Again, ask the court to reverse the trial court's opinion, reverse the court of appeals opinion, and remand this for a new trial.
Thank you, counsel. Foregoing, three cases are submitted on written briefs and oral arguments. That completes the business of the court for this morning.
Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes. Y'all
want to
Supreme Court second, now things adjourned.